For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. I'm so happy to be here. I have some old friends here and some new friends here, so that feels good. And in particular, it's wonderful to be able to be here with Tygen because I basically started writing almost accidentally a commentary on the Song of the Grass from Hermitage, which was originally translated by Tygen. And then Tygen was very supportive and encouraging in helping me move forward that project, which became my first book. So I have it's kind of like a million conditions produce any phenomenon, but the phenomenon of my being an author, few human beings have been more instrumental to that than Tygen. So I have a lot of appreciation for that. And look, people are making a community here, so that just feels good to see people in this room that can practice together. How wonderful. So mindfulness and intimacy is my theme. These are just two things that I really value. And I will, as I talk, sort of unfold why I bring these two ideas together in one framework. When I'm talking about mindfulness, I'm talking about it in a fairly conventional way. So I've studied the early Buddhist sutras on mindfulness, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, and the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutra, and a bunch of related texts, and then taken the practices unfolded there into my own body and mind, and then hung out with people who teach this and practice this in an embodied way, and explored these root teachings of mindfulness. So that's where I'm coming from when it comes to mindfulness. And then I'm going to read the first little bit of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about intimacy, which is maybe a little less conventional. Intimacy, in its simplest definition, means close familiarity and friendship. Words, however, have power and meaning beyond their definitions. No matter what the dictionary says, some words evoke very different meanings or feelings to different people. To some folks, the word religion evokes inspiration, warmth, and wonder. To others, constriction and closed-mindedness. Which kind are you? Intimacy is a word a bit like this. It can evoke feelings of connection and safety, but for some people it's pretty scary or stickily sentimental. And then there are the folks who think it just means sex. Is that you? When I was reading, I thought I'm going to write this book and I had the title, and then I went online and I was like, oh, this has been covered pretty well if that's what you mean. Anyway. Here, I will be pointing towards a way of understanding and experiencing the word intimacy that fosters compassion, calm, and joyful action. I use intimacy here in the way we often use it in Zen discourse. It's about harmony between autonomy and interdependence. In intimacy, we are individuals who are connected, and we are also one undivided whole. We can develop both healthy boundaries and healthy boundarylessness. So, you know, you may think, when you think intimacy, you may think like a romantic date with your beautiful baby on Friday night. And that can be a place for realizing the kind of intimacy I'm talking about. But here I'm talking about an intimacy that is available in all situations, but we just often don't recognize. So the way I'm using intimacy shows up a lot in translated Chan Zen texts. But it seems like a pretty accurate translation, so I can say these lines may be familiar to you if you've been around. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Not knowing is most intimate. What is the business under the patchwork robe? Intimacy. And we see many and many other instances and themes like this recurring. So, you know, in one sense, what they're pointing to is the mind-to-mind, the warm-hand-to-warm-hand transmission of the Dharma that is valued in Zen. The family, what's often called the family-style practice, where we actually get our bodies in the same place and we are together. But this is pointing towards something much broader. Basically, the methodology of being together so intimately, in the traditional sense, is a way of helping us recognize intimacy in a much broader sense. So, at the heart of what makes Mahayana distinct as a Buddhist tradition is the emphasis on interdependence. So, just the idea that because something exists, that is the only way anything else can exist. Technically, you guys may be really hardcore in here, you'd be like, I could say, because things appear to exist because of dependency. But I'm just going to say they exist. We'll do a shorthand here. We'll pretend they exist just for the course of this class. That's the way it seems to us. Anyway, so dependent on conditions, things appear to exist. One of the most beautiful formulations of this I could sum up comes from the Huayin Mahayana school, which emphasizes this and elucidates it the most spectacularly, where I would say each thing is dependent on everything, everything is dependent on each thing, everything is dependent on everything, and each thing is dependent on each thing. So however you want to unpack it, we have this situation where nothing arises without total dependence on infinite other conditions. So the Buddha, in early Buddhist sutras, repeatedly says that our karma is without discoverable beginning. That is to say, the conditions that produce each moment of experience are without discoverable beginning. He doesn't say infinite, because that's kind of hard to figure out. How much time do you have to look back into without discoverable beginning and find out whether it's infinite? It's going to take a while. Oh, infinity! Anyway, so really, really big. So it looks like we're looking at this small thing. Our mind is conditioned to say, oh, this is how it is. But what we're not seeing is the infiniteness. So if you're kind of going, wait a minute, I thought this was about intimacy. That was going to be like, you know, being in a small enclosed place together or being with someone you love. And all those are places where this can be realized. But the point here is that if everything is entirely dependent on everything else, everything is always as intimate as anything could ever be. If everything is always entirely dependent on everything else, everything is always as intimate as it could possibly be. So intimacy is how things are, or reality. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about reality, also known as intimacy. It's like another name. But, you know, it doesn't really seem that way a lot of the time, right? It doesn't really seem like everything is total intimacy. I tend to experience the world from a position of alienation, like I'm a separate thing and there's all this stuff that I either want to get some more of or get rid of, control, manage, judge, figure out. I don't think I'm alone in this tendency. I'm not sure. I certainly hope you don't have to have this happening all the time, but it seems quite probable. So we experience usually our experience is characterized by this sense of alienation rather than intimacy. But the basic tenet of Buddhism is that we are not victims of our karma. As I say, we're not victims of the conditioning. We are agents within conditioning. And in every single moment of consciousness, we have liberative capacity. And from the Mahayana perspective, the most liberative thing you can possibly do is recognize the intimacy that's already here. You don't have to become more intimate because it's too late. But you can learn to recognize the intimacy that's here. So there are various reasons why I wanted to put these ideas together, mindfulness and intimacy. I'll just say one of the most key ones has to do with the fact that we currently live in the wondrous time of the mindfulness movement, Yes. So maybe you people all came here because you're like, I'm not doing that stupid mindfulness. I'm going to hang out with all these cool Zen people and look way beyond mindfulness. Well, that's fine. But I will say, you can't not be a part of the mindfulness movement because you're always intimate with everything. Too late. So we have a part to play within this. So the mindfulness thing, I hope it's cool. I provide mindfulness training. I provide secular mindfulness training where I use the mindfulness practices, and then there's no religious context, and that enables me to go and do it in contexts where I couldn't otherwise, like police training, or I do a lot of work with people in addiction recovery. And I hope it's helpful. I do my best. But there are many very reasonable critiques of the mindfulness movement. And the strongest one that I will uphold here is that we start to get this thing where, you know, you have all these magazine articles, you maybe go to your job and you have a required mindfulness training or a optional one, and, you know, maybe it's someone at your company read a thing that said if you do mindfulness training, you'll have a more productive workforce. Oh, wow. I think that's in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, isn't it? So, I like to just be careful. You know, I'm not coming into your zendo and teaching Marxism, but I am going to quote Karl Marx, because Karl Marx was occasionally pretty insightful. So he once said, "Religion is the opiate of the masses." And the point here, the underlying idea, is that religious doctrines or religious traditions can be used within a system of harm to get people to just kind of go along and feel pretty more comfortable within it. And, you know, you could get the idea, I think, from reading these articles in the magazines or getting some mindfulness training at your workplace, that the idea is that you can just learn to get along with how things are and accept everything as it comes. Just accept everything. And I am unequivocal in my lack of interest in helping people to accept everything. We live in an environment where there is massive amounts of harm happening all the time with which we're already intimate. So we live in a country that is and has always been a white supremacy and a patriarchy. We live in a country where Islamophobia and anti-Semitism are on the rise, where transphobia and homophobia are endemic. And these are big words, but I'm just talking about people that I know being profoundly harmed, in case you're confused. You're like, well, I don't want to get into that. It's like, we're just talking about human beings suffering. And we have a way of consuming and producing things that is like devastating our world and our family, plants and animals and people and landscapes, and skies and waters. So, like, if mindfulness, if Buddhism comes into the U.S., and you know, there are a couple of people sitting around in the corner over here at my Zen Center and your Zen Center doing our thing, and, but mindfulness sweeps into the country and everyone just gets really good at being really chill and getting along with how things are, that is not going to help with a path of universal liberation. And that is not honoring the underlying idea of Buddhism, which is you have liberative capacity. You don't have, like, kind of getting along with things capacity. You have liberative capacity to free beings from suffering, ongoing. So I'm interested in people recognizing their intimacy with systems of harm. I want to be like, oh, the bad people do the harmful thing. What I want to learn to do is recognize I'm intimate with that whole thing. Everyone within it and all the process of it is something I'm a part of, I'm dependent on, it's dependent on me, and I have agency within it. What am I going to do? Instead of like, oh, can I just blame that over there? Can I just say swear words at a face that I see on the news? Not that I would ever do that. So, and many, many other people are talking about mindfulness in this way. This is not innovative. It's just I'm part of many people who are trying to make sure that this doesn't happen with Buddhist teachings in the United States. They don't just get subsumed So intimacy from the experiential side. I forgot. The other thing I want to say is about why I'm putting these two ideas together is that I didn't make this up at all. It actually is an innovation of a group of people who are doing something called Yogacara, which is something I think is really great. So Yogacara is a school of Buddhism that's about 2,000 years old. It doesn't exist as a distinct school, but its teachings are really, really influential throughout many, many different types of Buddhism. So, and it's about integrating early Buddhist, what we call Theravadan teachings, with Mahayana teachings. And the, if I was to take like the quickest summation of what this implies for our practice, is in Yogacara, they say there are two barriers to realization, the barrier of afflictive emotion and the barrier of delusion. And they say that early Buddhist mindfulness practices are really good at helping people shed patterns of afflictive emotion, and that Mahayana teachings on non-duality, or what I'm calling intimacy here, are really good at helping people open up into some vast sense of how their liberative energy can go out forever. So, you know, from that, the mindfulness is an object-based practice. So mindfulness very specifically says we're going to pick elements out of the flux of experience, we're going to name them, we're going to focus attention on them as distinct, separate phenomena, and that's going to be helpful. Now, our consciousness does this all the time. You know, your mind is always picking stuff out. Mindfulness is like, yep, we're going to use that capacity of mind, and we're going to start by saying, oh, this is the body. Ah, I'm identifying the body, separate, focus. And then you start to identify a whole bunch of other things, many of which are affective or emotional, which I'll talk a little bit about more in a minute. But so the idea is you are picking something out of the flux of reality, naming it, making it into a distinct object. And the thing is, we do this all the time, so it's just using that tendency. Well, that's very helpful, I think. I think so. And many people, they like this practice. It's really great. But then when you read Mahayana literature, you see the word mindfulness pretty rarely. It's not used very much. Like, if just simplest way to think about this is the Eightfold Path has mindfulness in it, the Six Paramitas don't. And the reason seems pretty clear. Mahayana sutras pretty relentlessly emphasize that the reason they're suffering or the way to go beyond suffering is to recognize that there are no objects that are ultimately real. And so the tendency is to say we should jump out of this tendency to see the world as like a bunch of distinct objects that bump up against each other and have to be manipulated and judged and all this stuff, and just jump into the fact that we're already intimate with everything beyond all those ideas and separations. And you don't even have to jump into it because it's too late. You already are it. Whoa. That's as zen as I'm going to get tonight. So what I just said might be like, you'd be like, oh, finally, we're actually talking about something that I value. Or you might have been like, that was really weird. I have no idea. But I will point out that it's like they're saying the whole problem is what mindfulness does, is make things into objects. So the thing is, I think, and Yogacara teachings say, these two approaches are actually much better when used in combination. In particular, mindfulness is really good for helping us to see and dissolve emotional habits. And this is de-emphasized enormously in Mahayana, and in particular in Chan and Zen literature, where the emotional part of life is not a particular area of emphasis. So I think that's one of the main reasons I bring these together. So when I have a book called Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, there are a lot of mindfulness practitioners who don't want to read it. So I wrote another book with a title that's less scary. So I will say a couple of other things here. Oops. We tend to experience or recognize mindfulness in very particular and personal ways. So we're really not all the same in this regard. So for me, I really feel, when I say feel, recognize intimacy, this, you might say you feel connected, you feel less, you're going to feel less agitated probably. You feel more supported. You feel more like what you're doing matters, and you see how it seems to be contributing to things. So everyone feels this way some of the time. Me, I feel this way like when I get out in nature. So I've been on the road for almost a month, driving around the country and teaching and meeting people. And I had a couple days off a couple weeks ago, and I immediately went straight into the Appalachian Mountains, went where no one could find me and put up a tent and didn't see anyone for like 48 hours. And it was great. I just sit out, I look at the trees, I look at the ground, I listen to the water. And for me, when that is happening, I just feel supported. I feel connected. I see how each individual thing I do is part of this whole unfolding process. And I feel my sense of intimacy just awakens. So you may be like this. You might be one of these people. You hear a lot of people say, oh, nature is my church. I've heard a lot of people say that. That's cool. On the other hand, you might be one of these people who are like, what? Nature is where the gross snakes are and the bugs and the mud and I don't know. That's not intimate at all. Well, we're not the same in how we recognize intimacy. Another example I like to use is family. Perhaps you're one of these people who says, when I get with my family, I just feel totally connected. I feel supported, deeply supported. I see how my energy naturally flows to do beneficial things, and I see that flowing back into me, and it's just great, wonderful. And you might also be like, hell no, that is not real at all. In fact, it might be really painful to even think that that can be possible because your experience in your family is so profoundly alienated. That's not uncommon. So both these things are, so it's not the situation that makes intimacy. The situation is always intimacy. The question is, to what degree are you able to recognize it? And back to the earlier point, we're not victims of our conditioning. So our conditioning produces the degree to which we recognize intimacy, and we can practice to expand the places where we recognize it. And this will change how we act. This will change how we act. Imagine, this is a thought experiment, like what if everyone in the United States really recognized how their consumption of fossil fuels impacted the world? There's no way there wouldn't be a profound and radical shift in how people acted. No way. But that's just an example. And this is true just in your personal relationships, at your work, all through your life. So I think I'm going to give you, being a Minnesotan, it is important generally to talk about Prince. I know you'd probably prefer I talk about Bob Dylan, but I'm going to talk about Prince. Yes, good answer. So Prince, I will say when I and many people watch Prince play music, you see a person pour themselves into the activity they're doing, of the singing and the dancing and the playing guitar or the piano or whatever it is, you see the person pour themselves into it, disappear into that activity, and something, a vast sense of mysterious connection is opened. This is very common. So, and this is very Soto Zen approach to practice, to do things with everything given into the activity. And a simple way to understand this in terms of intimacy is like, if you can lift up your spoon to lift up the spoon instead of lift up the spoon in order to get the food, if you can take a step just to lift your foot instead of to try and get somewhere, what is happening is you are dissolving the mind's tendency to make every activity into a means to get something else, which is ultimately and always alienating. There's always a separation created. And you're missing the fact that everything is already cooperating. So anyway, Prince would do this thing, and then, you could go into the room where he's playing music. You see 20,000 people being drawn by that immersion and total commitment into a vast sense of connection and intimacy. You see people weeping. Why are they weeping? Because they, some sense that cracking through the shell of their aloneness, and everybody's got their hands in the air singing, purple rain, no one knows what it means. Knowing what it means, this is what we were talking about when you were telling me, don't explain. He doesn't explain anything. He opens up a space for you to forget what you know. This is like, so a person can recognize intimacy or have some degree of recognition of it and then help other people to recognize it. This is a natural capacity that you all manifest. I will be shocked if you don't. Maybe you could prove it to me. I'll follow you around. But I'm pretty sure sometimes you recognize connection and it helps other people to recognize that. So this isn't a magical Buddha thing or a magical prince thing. It's just a normal human capacity that can be developed. My opinion is the function of a Buddhist teacher primarily is to do this activity of recognizing interdependence and interpersonally helping other people to make that recognition as well. Only a Buddha and a Buddha, to use the language of Dogen. So it's also true that Prince died when he was young, 58 years old, of a drug overdose when he was alone and in an elevator. Almost a, like, I don't know what could be more alienated sounding than that. Very painful. And this is a human thing. We may have wonderful capacities to realize intimacy, to help people open up into connection, and also have parts of ourselves that are profoundly wounded where we do harmful things. And it's not abnormal. It's the norm. My interest is in having people look at their lives and really recognize, where am I able to see this and where am I wounded? How can I use mindfulness to investigate those parts of myself that need to be seen? And we see this frequently and repeatedly in Buddhist communities with teachers who have an amazing capacity to help people awaken and also do really harmful things. Seen it many, many times. Many American sanghas have, in particular, male teachers who have abused their power to sexually abuse women, but the types of abuse are various, far beyond that. And this is like, I used to be really baffled by it, and now I'm just like, that is clearly a thing that happens. So it's just here, and now in this situation, because I can see more clearly, I'm more able to recognize that I can do something beneficial. So many people are doing things to work and try and make a Buddhism where people can actually be safe and there's less of this happening, which is great. And I like to think of myself as a part of that. And I encourage you to be a part of it. We can make something better by not hiding from the truth of it. Ida Wells, the great African-American journalist, once wrote, the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. This is a very Buddhist understanding. It's really powerful just to see. Just to see. So I'm going to read to you just a couple short sections of this book, and then I'm hoping that you will be willing to use your voices for questions or discussion. So the book is divided into just regular parts of our lives, like body, mind, heart, friends, teachers, community, art, nature. You get the idea. This is the beginning of the chapter called Heart. Have you ever seen someone laughing in the rain? Or someone stoop-shouldered, shuffling along on a green and sunny day. Perhaps at a time of crisis, you've seen someone respond with resolve and energy, and someone else collapse into fear or despair. Maybe someone you know gets testy, and then you know it's best to leave them alone. When a loved one is dying, sometimes people are overwhelmed with pain and can barely take care of their basic needs. And sometimes they leap into frantic action to avoid their feelings. And at other times, they only know one thing: profound, all-encompassing love. I've seen all this in others and in myself as well. One of the clearest insights of my years of meditation is how powerfully my emotions color my experience, my perception of the world. So when I go to an insight meditation place, we're all doing mindfulness. I spend all my time talking about the non-dual side. But here I want to talk about the mindfulness side. And I want to talk about my basically summing up the Vasubandhu's Yogacara approach to mindfulness. Be aware of your senses: sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. And so your body. This is pretty zen. I hope you're already picking up on this. But the other component is to be aware of your feelings. And it is my opinion that the most powerful practice that you have available to you is to know how you feel with mindfulness. Because people, huge amounts of human behavior and suffering is driven by feelings. Most of it unconscious. So I'm going to give you, let me say, practically speaking, what do I mean? This may seem like really simple. Throughout the day, repeatedly, just keep checking in. Is how do I feel? Notice how you feel, and that's it. It's not complicated. It's very hard to do sustained mindfulness of emotions for reasons that I don't want to get into. Basically, they're kind of amorphous. So that's hard to do. But when you're just practicing Zazen, you know how you're sitting and you're, whatever your practice is, most people tend to start to be more aware of sound, more aware of the visual field. So we tend to just become more aware of the senses. So just make sure that one of the senses you're becoming aware of is how you feel, which in Buddhist psychology is just, it's part of experience. You might be like, duh, but actually our feelings tend to get kind of shunted and hidden away. And repression is not helping.
Which is why I recommend a mantra from another Minnesotan who says, how does it feel?
To be on your own. Okay. Da, 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 da. Okay. So, to be on your own. Okay. So, no offense. Anyway. I want to just give you 3 minutes of Yogacara karma theory, because that's really what you need, or something. Anyway, so basic idea, and you'll hear the Thich Nhat Hanh in here, because that's where he gets his language around this. When an emotional or cognitive thing happens in consciousness, it plants a seed, so a similar thing will occur. But there's a little addendum. When an emotional or cognitive thing happens in consciousness of which we are not mindful, it plants a seed, and a similar thing will occur. And I can unpack there's all kinds of Buddhist doctrine embedded in this. But the point being that, say, you're angry. If you're not aware of the state of anger itself, it will plant a seed, and later on, anger will occur. Important to note that anger may occur later today, later next year, later in 50 years, or later in 5,000 years, or 500,000 lifetimes. And I know you may not be, you'd be like, well, we're very rational here. We don't do the rebirth thing, so. The point is that someone will receive the fruit of what you did. Someone will receive the fruit of you being angry without being aware of it. That may be you. It may be someone else. It may be a reborn you. I don't really care. Someone is receiving it. It matters. That is the underlying message. It matters. So, generally speaking, we're not... Now, if you're mindful of the feeling, it doesn't plant another seed. So here's how this works. Normally, let's say I'm really anxious, and so there's a feeling of anxiety, but I don't really know the feeling of anxiety. I just know, oh my gosh, is the bad thing going to happen? No, I think it's going to work out. No, it's not. Oh my God. Right? So the mind is completely consumed on the cognitive level, and awareness of the emotion is very modest. So because this isn't being seen, there's just seeds being planted and planted, conditioning the world or consciousness or experience to have more anxiety. And we could go through all different kinds of feeling states. Conversely, if you can be mindful of the feeling state itself, not describing it, thinking about it, or anything, just seeing it and feeling it, something else happens. So, like when there's a feeling of, say, anger, and anger is here. Now, normally you're like, you don't notice the anger. You're just like, oh, that guy's a dick. But instead, you could be like, oh, there's a feeling here. So previous anger is bearing fruit in the form of this anger now. But instead of it just planting another seed, you see it, and that seed's energy is exhausted in the light of awareness. So you've healed a past pattern of anger. And you're planting seeds, because you're always planting seeds in consciousness. What seeds are you planting? Compassionate awareness. Because you're just being aware of feelings. What compassion means is being with feelings. Actually, technically, being with suffering. Compassion. So you heal past patterns, and you plant seeds, compassionate awareness. Simple, powerful practice. I'm going to read one more little thing here. This part I'm reading because it's about someone I just really love and admire. Tomoe Katagiri is, as far as I know, having done a fair amount of research, the first person to teach the sewing of Zen Buddhist robes in the United States. This practice is very beautiful. There are many people, it's their main expression of Soto Zen practice. I was just in Boston and everyone was talking about how great it was when Lori comes and helps them sew. It's a big deal for people. I know people, that's how they do Soto Zen. So, Tomoe. Oh, and Tomoe's husband, Dainin Katagiri, was the founder of Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, where I still teach and in whose lineage I am a teacher. But he died about 25 years ago, and Tomoe is alive and well. Tomoe Katagiri taught me well, mostly by staying by my side and quietly pouring her energy into what we were doing together. Tomoe-san helped bring the art of sewing Zen monks' robes from Japan to the United States, and she was my teacher in sewing the robes that symbolized my ordination. She gave me precise instruction in the technical aspects of sewing, with which I am far from adept. Just to be clear, I'm really bad, and I don't much like doing it. It's good practice for me, but let's just be honest. But to me, her real teaching lay in her embodiment of patience, attention to the present moment, and quiet, warm intimacy. It was not uncommon, as we worked side by side, for us to be silent for an hour at a time to support wholehearted focus on each stitch. After the entire robe is sewn, which took me about a year, it is carefully ironed and folded precisely, like origami, ironed and folded. I frequently found the sewing process frustrating, but she just calmly stitched away beside me. I recall the moment when I finished the final stitch, a moment I had been waiting for. I said, Tomoe, I finished the robe. I was ready for a birthday cake, or maybe some fireworks. She put down her sewing and moved to stand up, and she said, I'll turn on the iron. I don't think she was consciously teaching me, but she brought me right back to what was in front of me. She modeled not living for some other time when the current task, the current manifestation of life, is done. She hadn't been waiting for me to finish, and she realized nothing is ever really finished. Life goes on. All things connect. She took care of the world by focusing on the life at hand, and that was teaching enough for me. Well, thank you for your kind attention. I would love to hear if people have questions or comments, answers, or anything. Other voices. Yes.
Have you been working on your book for a while? This most current. This is recently published.
This was published in February, and I don't even know. I tend to write kind of quickly, and this one didn't involve research, so I can't even remember. But it's less time than a lot of my friends who have a harder time. So my previous book was really hard, but this one just kind of unfolded pretty quickly. Yeah. Yeah.
I can somehow react to the environmental destruction of my neighborhood or the environmental conditions or the social conditions of my neighborhood, perhaps of my city, perhaps of my state. And then after that, it's just like a lot. Which is to say sometimes that in thinking in the contemporary moment about environmental degradation, we are frequently thrown into a kind of very large context or a very large scale. And sometimes that feels like the grief of hundreds of years of existence, if not more. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that feels like an entire globe of suffering. And so I think for me, sometimes in working with this, but also talking to people about this, which is part of my work, I feel frequently a kind of overwhelm and even aggressive, which is to say, how can we be intimate with these conditions without becoming overwhelmed by the sheer scale
Yeah, it's a good question. It is, I would say, to my mind, Mahayana Buddhism, this is the fundamental question. How do we continue to feel like joyful agents of liberation within an almost infinitely vast condition of suffering? Because it's pretty explicit in Buddhism, like our particular horrifying environment is like the way the universe is. So samsara is like, it's no joke. He's like, we start from the idea that suffering is almost infinitely vast. So this may seem oxymoronic, but the idea is to actually keep remembering the frame is so big that we're not in control. So like, we're not deciding, apocalyptic thinking. We're trying to remove that. Also, we're going to fix it all thinking is gone. And we're liberated into the moment. So one of the first things from a Buddhist frame is to come down to like, we're liberated into the moment. Within, oh my gosh. But then you're like, okay, that's cool, but practically speaking, come on, man. So then I'll bring this to like earlier in the reading, I mentioned healthy boundaries and healthy boundarylessness. So as we start to shed our boundaries and really open up to how painful this is, yeah, that can be motivating, but it can be overwhelming. That's where the basic boundariedness of mindfulness is very helpful. So mindfulness is about creating boundaries. It's about saying, this is a distinct thing and this is where I'm focusing. The simple thing is, if you're emotionally overwhelmed, that is where your energy should go, in my opinion. So as soon as you start to feel, and I do this constantly in conversation, I'm just having a conversation with someone and it gets heated, at a certain point, I'm like, oh, now I see the thing where my greatest power is. It's just in being attentive to my emotional state and taking care of it. And then I take care of it, and then it enables me to come back and expand my frame. So that'd be my short answer. Short as I can get. Yes.
Thank you so much for the talk. I've been trying to be mindful with my emotional experience, like you suggested, but I found it quite challenging to strike that balance to actually just be mindful and allow myself to fully experience it, whatever that emotion is. Like when I feel anger, it's so easy when I'm aware of it, so easy to just try to push it away, stop being angry. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like giving myself instruction.
Yeah.
Don't do this. And at the same time, I'm also aware that I'm not supposed to do that. I'm supposed to allow myself to fully experience it.
Mm-hmm.
So how to deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one thing I'll say is, like, mindfulness is really, really powerful. There are Buddhist teachings that are just like, if you feel angry, you should just say, I'm going to not be angry now. And actually, that can work and it can be okay. But if you, so like sometimes I'll start to get irritated. I'll be like, you know what? I just don't need to go there. It's not a big deal. And I can just be like, that's fine. But you want to start to be sensitive to whether that feels repressive or just sort of like, oh, I don't need to do that. It's a feeling. So all of this will be very amorphous, like feeling state stuff. There's not, that's what your mind wants to be like, oh, I got a tool and I figured it out. And it's always going to be like, oh, am I repressing? I'm not sure. So it's a matter of softening and being sensitive. And that's mostly, it's an internal personal process, but you can keep giving yourself the message that how you feel matters, that you're willing to be there for yourself. Remind yourself that this is actually something that's beneficial for everybody. So you frame it. And then as you see yourself doing, you know, that sort of like shunting away, don't attack that. You can be mindful of that. And so you just kind of soften into it. There's no, once this becomes a kind of a grabbing, we're just reinforcing the problem. Thank you. Yeah.
I hope this won't wind up sounding too thinky or whatever. But I really, and I would just like to take this opportunity. Anybody who's got enough, you should buy this new book. You should also buy the Vipassana, which is one of the better things I've ever read on the topic. And we heard a little bit of that here about the way the Yogacara stuff brings together the kind of mindfulness tradition, and, if you will, out of the Abhidharmic stuff, and then the Mahayana. In your talk, there was this sort of, you sort of implicitly noted that too much of a focus on mindfulness sort of overshoots the middle way, right? Because it's this, like, without doing something else, it's always like object, 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 which is always separation, 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 which is always alienation, alienation, which is always suffering, suffering. Did I get that? Am I understanding you at that point?
Well, I kind of said that, but I will also amend it a little bit. But do you want to keep going?
Is, what's the correlative missing of the mark on the Mahayana side, the non-separation side? Is there one? Can you? I mean, and if nothing comes to mind,
no. I have a critique. I have a critique. I want to get excommunicated as soon as possible. So no, I'll say like. With mindfulness, the thing is, like, if you really study mindfulness, you see the idea actually is to then begin to dissolve the alienation within it. But the Mahayana critique of it de-emphasizes that. So, like, I think a person who's really good at teaching mindfulness, knows it deeply, can see it as a way. I mean, ultimately, it's a way of seeing that nothing that you see is a self, so that you recognize intimacy. So, but it's just not being taught that way very much. And the Mahayana tradition just thinks people got caught with the methodology. That's kind of what I was talking about with you, is you get caught, you're like, can I just get a tool? Our mind wants that stupid tool. So we get caught on the tool, and this is about sensitivity. But then the critique, I think that overemphasis of non-dual practices, you lose the psychological precision of mindfulness. I think it is really important for people to cultivate the capacity to know when they're experiencing anger, when they're experiencing anxiety, when they're experiencing desire, because those things can help us. I can just be like, sweet, I'm one with everything, so I'm one with you, and then bad things happen. Bad things happen.
Yeah.
Whereas I could be like, well, I'm recognizing I'm part of everything, and yet, this feeling, this particular feeling is producing some unhealthy impulses that may manifest into action. So, yeah.
Thanks for your talk, and I loved your book on the Sangha.
Well, thank you.
The other book is that all of his books are available. I wanted to push you a little bit in sort of a friendly way on how you're thinking about intimacy, right? And so there's this tendency, and so you sort of explicitly talked about it, to see intimacy as going along with the family, and it's going along with the home, and to see all of these as spaces of care and love and protection. And a lot of feminist theorists and a lot of anthropologists informed by feminist theorists, I'm an anthropologist, have argued that when we look at families, we do see that, but we see often families as deeply hierarchical. And we see families and homes as spaces of vulnerability to violence and spaces of violence. And relations with social intimates as ones that can also be relations of suffering. So I guess there's this valence of intimacy in a lot of your talk. It's this very positive valence of intimacy. Is intimacy also violence and suffering?
Yes.
And
hatred and greed? Yeah. Yeah, so that's what I was saying. Like, that's why I want people to recognize they're intimate with white supremacy, intimate with patriarchy, intimate with environmental destruction, intimate with anti-Semitism. It's not something somewhere else. It's, we are always a part of it. All violence. Intimacy is not the absence of conflict, either in the conventional sense or the sense I'm talking about. So absolutely, and you know, when I was talking about family, why do some people feel terribly alienated in family? It's probably not because things in that family are healthy. So yeah, definitely. But so the thing is, to recognize intimacy is to recognize that you have a part to play in the possibility of liberation. That's, but it's not going to be about controlling. So I would say one of the easiest ways experientially to recognize the degree to which you're recognizing intimacy is the degree to which your mind is focused on controlling an external object. So intimacy can never be in the positive sense about control. So at the root of our tradition is this thing that you can act. You have act. But if you look through Buddhist literature, the number of things that are discussed that are controlling external objects is almost nil. The Eightfold Path is all things that you do in the way you pay attention and the way you act. So we can begin to be free, like within systems of violence, to say, in any given moment, there's something I can do that will be liberative. And that's what I'm trying to get people down to, that point of recognizing their power, their inherent power, but recognizing that power isn't a power of controlling, but a power of offering something liberative. And then there's large questions of what is skillful, but I encourage you to explore it.